Preston and Steve Fun Size Podcast.
Our next guest does a tour of some bars and breweries and talks about murders and things like that. It's a very interesting concept because we're fascinated with stories of evil and mayhem and all of that.
It does fascinate us.
And the series is called Felonious, the Sordid History of Philadelphia Murder and Mayhem. And the host of these events is right here. This is Sarah Kalin.
Yay!
Is
here.
Hi.
Hello, Sarah. How are you?
I am well. Thank you so much for having me.
Our pleasure. So you are uniquely qualified to speak about such things. Can you tell us a little bit about your background?
Sure. So the first portion of my childhood, teen, and early adult life, I was in theater. And then at the age of 23, I decided, no, what I really want to do is be a cop. Oh.
Yeah.
And I went and did that. And I was a police officer for about 10 years and then decided what I really wanted to do was move into academia and study serial killers and serial sexual predators.
Wow.
And so, and I'm still doing that. I do work as a cold case homicide investigator.
You consult for various organizations?
And, I do, yeah. I usually work directly with an agency. I have at times done it for like documentary film stuff where I'm not necessarily connected to the agency.
Right. You are a filmmaker as well, correct?
I am. And I'm actually working on a doc right now where we are embedded. The doc is embedded with me and with the agency investigating a 26-year cold case in Alabama.
I was looking at the trailer, or I guess a teaser that's up for this, and it's there are explain that story that you're doing and how you approach something, a cold case that's decades old.
Well, gosh, that's a great question.
Yeah.
Really what you want to do with something that, like the way I go into one that's really, really old is literally to start from the beginning. And so any
case,
as if the crime just happened.
Yeah, yeah.
But with the advantage of also having the original investigator's notes and stuff
right.
like that. Now, the one that you probably saw the trailer was the one out of Oklahoma.
Yes,
and that
yes.
one, we were not working in partnership with the police agencies.
Okay.
So that one was tougher. It was harder. There were a lot of FOIA requests. There was a lot of difficulty in getting access.
Is that a difficulty sometimes? Because sometimes I we see it depicted in movies a lot of times where don't want to step on toes, and sometimes you get that. Is that in fact the case a lot of times?
A lot of times, because I think and understandably in an investigation, especially for something as serious as a homicide or a disappearance, there is often a sense of like a need to know basis.
Yeah.
And even within an agency, when I was an officer, you know, sometimes I'd be working on something in the detective bureau and the patrol officers are not even made aware of necessarily what's going on in the course of an investigation. Everything's very, very tight. But and there are times when that's still really important. But what we're starting to see, and with the advent of really good investigative journalism when it comes to true crime, is more and more agencies are realizing that they can walk a line with that and that there are some advantages to having fresh eyes, to having outsiders, and even to having more public awareness. So you can hold a lot of stuff back and still work with people.
Sure.
It's akin to my family and I, we put together jigsaw puzzles, and you can sit there and you can look for this one piece for freaking ever, and it's just, you just can't find it. And somebody else walks in and goes, oh, yeah, it's right there.
Right there.
You know what I mean?
Yep.
And so a fresh set of eyes,
yeah.
a different perspective, giving you a break for a moment because you're so buried in one direction, I would imagine.
That's exactly what happens. You sort of get blinders on. Yeah. And so the next project that I'm working on, this case in Alabama, is very different. The agency has brought me in and is essentially letting me lead the investigation.
What are the specifics of this case?
This, in November of 1993, a man testing his, like, he got new brakes and he was out testing on a dirt road next to the highway and found the remains of a decapitated female who had been thrown essentially off the high, like,
right.
you know, just
discarded.
Tossed out, discarded. Yeah. And at the time, they did investigate as well as I think the agency had the tools to do so, you
right.
know, at that time. But 1993 was a very different time in law enforcement. And all the stuff that we think of now that is sort of everybody thinks is kind of universal, like, oh, you know, fire starting and animal torture is definitely indicative of serial killers and stuff like that. This is all like everybody watches CSI or whatever thinks they know this stuff.
It's true.
That work had only just been published in the late 80s and early 90s. So a lot of agencies didn't know this stuff.
Right.
And so there were things when I opened up this case, I was like, well, this is clearly based on this. This looks like this. This looks like that. That was stuff that wasn't even in the toolbox at the time.
Yeah.
And so you know, as you said, I'm just starting from scratch. I've got 5,000 pages of case notes. I literally have gone through every single note, every single name, made a database for everything, and then I start pulling it in.
In a second, we're going to ask you about some of the cases in Philadelphia. We're eventually going to get to that. But Nick was telling me, Sarah, that you're a fan of the show Mindhunter, which my wife and I delved into, and we're going to watch it a second time as well. And it's funny that you bring up the techniques and so forth, because that is about the development of the behavioral sciences. And at first, cops and so forth were resistant to any of these things as far as techniques go of looking into the mind of these people to find answers. Are there new things and new ideas that are popping up that maybe are hard to get officers or the powers that be interested in because they might be a little radical or a little different than we're used to running?
100%.
Okay.
I mean, yeah, as a field, law enforcement tends to be small C conservative, right? Like where it's like, well, this has worked really well, so we need to stick with this. But it's funny that you would bring that one up. That was the original Mindhunter book, which John Douglas wrote 25 years ago, was what made, like, I was three chapters into that my first week in the police academy, and I was like, oh, this is what I'm going to do with my life.
Okay.
But yeah, there are developments still in profiling now. Like, there are changes along the way, and the FBI, Behavioral Science Unit, and John Douglas and stuff, they tend to be much more receptive of those advancements now. But we've seen cases where when the science changes, an agency may be reticent and there are mistakes made because of it. There was a case in Texas around 2000 at the time that fire science was changing drastically. Arson, you know, up until 2000 was looked at very, very differently. And then the science kind of got turned on its head and we found out that there were all these convictions that were probably not actually arson. And there were people walking free where they probably had committed arson. And a man was executed because the agency refused to take in the new science.
Was there some sort of some epiphany or something, or was it a series of conclusions that they came to that sort of reversed what they were thinking? Because arson, to me, you know, we think of these things. Oh, this is one category. This is another category. But I'm sure the thing that drives somebody to commit arson may have a certain DNA connected to someone who's a serial killer. Is that correct or is that incorrect?
Yeah, no. And definitely what you're talking about psychologically.
Yeah.
But in this case, what had happened was the actual science.
The actual science.
The actual science of arson study. Like,
would anything specifically come to mind that they had believed that led to this
person? They had believed that certain, like the way the fire licks the walls and stuff,
right,
like that in certain places was indicative of like a splash pattern of this and that and everything. And like with most science, it's sort of constantly under review. And mm-hmm. so it was academics at universities who were doing, you know, follow-up studies and saying, we're finding different stuff.
Mm. Yeah.
And they were presenting that to this Texas agency at the time, and they just said, no, we can't. It's got to be this guy. And
that
it
was
wasn't.
It. Wow. Yeah.
So Sarah obviously knows what she's talking about, and that's what she does. She talks about these things, these true crime lecture events, and you've got one coming up on Thursday at the Tin Can Bar from 7 to 9.
Yep.
How do these roll out? Do you have a presentation? Do you open up the floor? What do you do?
It is a little bit of everything.
Okay.
So what I like to do is take this stuff. And you know, everybody is fascinated by this. True crime definitely is in a renaissance right now. I think as long as we're always careful where we're punching up and we're never, you know, making victims the punchline or anything, we can have fun with it, too. People can learn and be fascinated by this and also have a good time. So it is audience engaged. We do a trivia component. You know, we make fun of some really stupid criminals.
It's the dichotomy, though, of it. Yeah. And we talk about this. And again, you're talking about, like, you know, the Dateline specials, the podcast, the things that police procedurals. We're all fascinated with this. And you said something that really does ring true, is you don't want to re-victimize the victims. But it does allow us to understand, you know, that there is this happening out there. You do thematic things as well. I was looking at some of the things that you have coming up. There is Romance is Dead, Black Widows, Lethal Lovers, things of that nature. And there's an 80s theme and so on and so forth. So you bunch them all into certain things. What do you find is the most fascinating to the audiences that show up to your lack of a better term, performance?
No, it does turn into a performance. Honestly, I don't know that there's any one thing. Everybody kind of has has a fascination they're excited by, and that's why I kind of try and mix it up. And Felonious is my signature event because,
right,
obviously it's Philadelphia, and it's the greatest city on earth. Yeah. And so obviously we want to hear these crazy cases.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, yeah, there's another one coming up a week from tomorrow at the Devil's Den, which is the Warriors and the Wicked. And it's a celebration of women across true crime. So it'll be some of the law enforcement trailblazers and these like crazy female serial killers.
And real life Clarice Starlings and stuff like that.
Absolutely.
So I wonder sometimes about child predators and the psyche behind a child predator, because it just seems like that's like the worst thing that you could do, right? And as people are doing this, if they realize, if they know what they're doing is bad, or and why sometimes they don't think of what might happen down the line, and why I don't hear or see of revenge more often. When somebody has been perpetrated upon as a youngster, when they finally have a voice and or, you know, whatever, as they're older. If you remember the movie Sleepers.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
That was like a revenge movie. And you don't hear about that all that often. Does that happen more often than we hear about?
No. I mean, I think for the most part, what you're describing, the two different people on the two different sides of that coin.
Yeah.
One has impulse control problems and the other does not.
Right.
Now, what you will see more frequently is victims of child predation when they are children will grow into predators.
Happen.
That's an astonishing thing. And it's
terrible. And they usually feel as bad about it as they are unable to, you know, to control it.
It just boggles the mind that you can be so horrifically traumatized that you become what you fear.
Yep.
Do you ever dive into the case of those two people from that were on South Street that disappeared that nobody's ever been able to figure out what happened?
We just did a big true crime story on them.
Yeah, I do know that story. And actually, that's sort of a theme that I get people sending me emails from around the country. They're like, my cousin or my roommate or whatever went to a bar and like there's footage of them going in and never seen again. It's kind of, South Street is not unique in that. There's a really famous one in Columbus. There's a
they
couple
just disappear.
Around the country. They just disappear.
They were in a pickup truck, right?
A pickup truck.
Outside of the TLA and then nobody ever saw them again. And it's just one of those mysteries that people seem to gravitate to because it just seems so odd that they up and vanished.
Yeah, Nick, I happened to hear it was 2005, February, okay. And it was Richard Patrone and Danielle Imbo, I think their names were.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And just went missing. On your looking at your Twitter or one of your social medias, there's if people want to do nefarious things and want to disappear, they can. But it's weird because we always think, you know, they say the long arm of the law. Effectiveness wise, how good are we now at bringing people to justice who perpetrate the kind of acts that you explore?
When everything is done right, when the right tools are used, we are very, very good at it now.
Good.
And we are getting better because when the science is embraced. I mean, quite frankly, we talk about the long arm of the law, and that's great, but the long arm of science is even better. I mean, we're at a point now with touch DNA and the invention of the MVAC system where, you know, my glasses here, I just put those down and 20 years from now, they can pull my DNA off there without even trying.
It's a mind blower.
It's amazing.
Let me ask you on that note, is the plethora of procedural shows and documentaries and Discovery ID and all of those things, is that also helping to cultivate a more learned criminal element?
Mm-hmm. I mean, maybe.
Yeah.
But I don't think so. I think it's rerouting some criminal decisions. But eventually, okay, it's like the noose is sort of, you know, tightening around a lot of different ways to try and get away with stuff.
Yeah.
And we're seeing that with all this stuff with GEDmatch, with the genealogical stuff, which, by the way, it was, you know, the Michelle McNamara book and the, you know, the GSK case and everything that got all the attention. But it was actually a woman who did the Barbara Rae Ventner was the one who did the genealogy mapping to find him. So
the GSK case?
Yeah, the Golden State Killer.
It was Patton Oswalt's wife.
Yeah. And the agents out there, the Paul Holes and the other detectives and stuff, who did a phenomenal job. But everybody talks about this genealogical stuff where they were able to get him through, you know, through family trees. And that's actually, that was a woman.
So,
these are the kinds of things I talk about.
What are some favorite subjects in Philadelphia true crime? What are some, you know, are there high profile cases or just what do you like to to dabble in, or what do people seem to respond to?
Well, what I really like to do, especially with the Filonius case, is go way back in history, because there are some crazy cases. One of my favorites is Anton Probst, who essentially just got mad because he didn't want to work on the farm that he worked on, and it was raining, and he hacked 7 family members up with an axe.
Oh my gosh.
Because he just, you know, was just like, God, I'm so sick of this dang rain, and like just kind of lost it. And that was just on a farm in South Philly in, like, you know, early 19th century.
So that would qualify as a mass murderer?
That would qualify as a mass
murderer.
There's
another gentleman. Another lunatic, a guy, because I tried to call up some stuff here to throw at you, because I think this is, you know, H.H.
So H.H. Holmes is,
listed as the first mass murderer?
He is often credited with the term, he's called the first American serial killer, and it's just patently untrue.
Right.
But it is, I do talk about him in Filonius, because although he's most notorious for the murder castle in Chicago when he killed all the people during the World's Fair in Chicago, it was actually a murder he committed in Philadelphia while he was living here down at 13th and Callow Hill that led to him being apprehended, and then he was executed here, and he is buried here.
And he had in fact, there was a question as to now whether or not he was actually buried. Who is the guy who actually one day took a rifle and just started walking? It was I think it was in this area. I'm jotting down all these. There's apparently a lot of lunatics in the area.
Oh yeah, a lot of lunatics everywhere.
Yeah, yeah. But I mean, I was surprised at how many nefarious people. In historically speaking, Preston does a segment called The Historian, and then a lot of this stuff is highlighted that are from this area. But if you even come more recently, people like Ira Ironhorn and other
I talk
cases.
About him in Filonius too. You guys will have to come.
Are people like Gary Heidnik? I hate to say like a hit parade, but that's obviously when you think about this area. What's your story with him, and have you reviewed that whole case history a lot?
Yeah, so Heidnik, I also talk about in Filonius. Yeah. It really is sort of like a greatest hits, but with some of the really old stuff that people had not heard of. Heidnik was a raging narcissistic personality disorder with violent tendencies.
Would he be a classic example of what we perceive to be what movies portray the classic serial killer as?
Yeah, he would definitely be, like, there's sort of like 2 or 3 avenues that fictional representations like to go with, and he certainly is in one where he was popular and well liked in certain ways. He was very successful in certain ways, and then always had people had a sense of him being kind of creepy and didn't really want to be around him. And he had a lot of the components. He had severe head trauma as a kid. He, you know what I mean, abused as a kid. So he's kind of got all the markers.
And that would be true of like John Wayne Gacy as well, who was in his regular professional life, was able to conduct everything and had this Pogo the Clown side thing that was obviously horrific.
Yeah, clowns are horrific.
You cover the mob or is that something separate?
I feel like you guys have been to the show. So I do try and do a rundown of the 70s, 80s mob wars in Philly as best as I can. And in fact, it's got a little Bruce Springsteen strand running through it, you know, because we start out with the Chicken Man being killed in Philly last night.
Was that predicated on a real?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
It sure was. And it was sort of what kicked off the stuff with Bruno and Nick.
Scarfo?
Yep. That was all tied in with that, and then the war that happened out of that was based on the Chicken Man being
killed.
Let
me ask you if this is true. I saw this name, Harrison Marty Graham. Does that strike a bell? Here's a guy who's a murderer, because I didn't know what you would know, because it's apparently there's a lot. This guy apparently had a puppet that he walked around with.
Oh, God. No, I'm not familiar with him, but I'm going to go ahead and jot that one down.
who to you is the great enigma? Who is at least of all the people associated with this area, who presents to you the most the largest menu of head scratching elements
in the Philadelphia region?
Yeah.
Honestly, there is a case that was known as the Frankfurt Slasher in the 80s and 90s. That once again, a man died in prison for, and I think it, without a shadow of a doubt, had nothing to do with.
Really?
And that was in, you know, the Frankfurt area of the city. And there were a lot of women killed, very similar styles. I mean, similar MO and signature. So they were certainly all linked, most of them, if not all of them. And that's never been solved. And the last one was in gosh, I want to say 1990. And I honestly, when I have some free time, I kind of want to sit down and plow through that one a little bit.
On the national level, the Zodiac Killer is one that's just, you know, tweaks my melon because it's so bizarre. It's such a wild
case. I thought
it
was Ted Cruz. Didn't we solve that?
Wait, it was Ted Cruz?
There was a whole thing going around. That was a whole thing on Twitter that Ted Cruz was the Zodiac Killer.
Well, there we go.
But my question about that is a case like that, because, you know, a couple times a year you hear it very well could have been this person. It very well, you know, we have evidence that shows this and that. Is there a time when it is just too far gone and there's no way to connect the dots to definitively say who done it when it comes to a case like that? Because a lot of the forensic stuff, the things that were collected and saved are gone or missing. And you know, if at some point, if there's just no physical evidence, you're just going to have to let that one go, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I think we certainly always want to have the attitude that there could be something that could come to light, that somebody did know something, or somebody, even if it's, you know, 50 years ago, that somebody told their grandkid on their deathbed, you know, something like that.
But it's still hard to believe things like that.
Of course, and then it's really hard to verify it. So, yeah, there's a difference between a case that maybe we think, well, this is almost certainly what happened and we have a solution, but that it would not be provable in court or something like that. I think, sadly, the JonBenet Ramsey case is probably going to be like that because there was so much done at the time maybe that was incorrect, or that, you know, there was too much contamination of physical evidence and everything, that it's like we're probably really never going to have an answer to
that. Is the contamination of a crime scene the biggest culprit when it comes to destroying?
It is certainly up there on the list. Yeah. How crime scenes are handled is just so important. And again, the science, as we get better and better at that, it's less and less of a problem.
How often do you have, I mean, and how often does it legitimately happen where somebody does something, there's a series of crimes, say a serial killer, and then takes a long pause and then starts it up again? You know, because I think in this day and age of copycats and fascination, and now there are people who are like very, you know, sick who tie into these people. There's a show called Prodigal Son that sort of keys on this, that people copy these people.
Yeah.
Is there any case that comes to mind where somebody took a long pause?
Absolutely.
Really?
Oh, yeah. So the way, you know, we talk about the three different types of multiple killers, where it's spree killing, mass killing, and serial killing. And what defines a serial killer, what separates a serial killer from a spree especially, is what's called the cool down period. So a cool down period, you know, they tend, think of it as like a little circle, almost like a recycling circle with the arrows. And so, there is the explosion of whatever the violence is. And then immediately after that, there is a cool down period where that release has been felt and they don't feel compelled, you know, to commit acts again. And then there's sort of a build.
The pressure valve.
The pressure valve starts to build, and then oftentimes there's a precipitating factor, and then we have another explosion. So the cool down period and the build vary from person to person. There's no way to know because each serial killer is a snowflake. There's no way to know what is driving that. What we do know is that cycle tends to tighten over time.
Okay.
So
it's like drinking, it sounds like. Put a good buzz on, it feels great. And then after that, you're like, God, I can't do that again for a little while.
But the
deeper you get into it, the more you're going at it.
Yeah. Well, it's like anything essentially that gives you a high or gives you a release. Yeah, you need more and more, and that's why you'll see an escalation in the violence too.
Does a particular case come to mind where someone took a long pause and then returned?
Well,
BTK did.
There are a lot of those, and Green River also had some long hiatuses. Yeah. Golden State Killer. But Bundy is part of the reason that I find Bundy fascinating, aside from I grew up in Florida and he was executed right outside my hometown, so he was kind of like a boogeyman over my childhood. Yeah. But what's fascinating about him is we sort of saw his whole professional career, as it were, as that cycle tightened and tightened and tightened, because what happens is, you know, the cool down period gets less and the violence gets more intense, and then they lose all control. So while he was once fairly organized and
he
meticulous,
sloppier.
He got very, very sloppy. By the end, it was just this explosion of violence.
Sarah, have you spent time with serial killers and or murderers? And if so, does it ever chill you to the bone? Does it ever affect you outside of the professional realm?
Anybody that I've spent time with like in the criminal element. I try and compartmentalize to some degree. So anything I'm doing, whether it's direct contact or if it's just research, you know, on a case, or if I'm working on a case like right now where it's like I'm about to, you know, I'll be back down in Alabama interviewing potential suspects, including there's a serial killer from Baton Rouge who we think might be worth looking at in this one. To me, it is work, and it's all about the mind, and it's all about kind of getting into their mind. And, you know, yeah, it's chilling, but I think in a moment when I'm doing it, I'm just trying to do the work. But I do definitely have like a system for emotional showers that I do. Like I'm a big rom-com. Like when I'm done work, I gotta, you know,
when
watch
Harry
Cougar Town.
Okay.
Yeah, exactly.
Nice.
I would not be a good investigator though, because I like meet one person that I didn't like and I'd be like, oh yeah, he did it.
So that's sort of half the fun. I do that on this case in Alabama. I was like, oh my God, this guy definitely did it. And then I find another one and I'm like,
Maybe he did it too.
Yeah, I don't know.
Well, listen, Sarah, if you're just tuning in, is Sarah Kalin, who's here, is going to be hosting another one of these events, True Crime Lecture event, and it's called Felonious Second, or The Sordid History of Philadelphia Murder and Mayhem. The next event is coming up on Thursday at the Tin Can Bar, 7 to 9, but you hit some other places like Devil's Den and Khyber Pass. And
yeah, Khyber Pass is every fourth Wednesday.
Okay.
We're upstairs at the Khyber Pass, and so it'll be a different event.
Do you have a schedule posted anywhere? People can check that out.
Best thing to do is my Twitter, which is just my name reversed, Kalin Sarah.
We need to get you a website, because when I was doing research, I'm like, oh, we got to get.
I know. I've been thinking about that too. Yeah. So if anybody, web designers want to volunteer for me,
well, you'll be able to access your information on PrestonandSteve.com. We'll post that up. We'll post on social media how people can find out more.
Wait, I have to ask you guys something now. So I was listening to the last guest. Why didn't anybody talk about how gorgeous my husband is?
Oh, yeah. He is
husband. I mean, I
just wanted to make sure we covered that. You know, we're going to equal opportunity.
I didn't want to make you feel uncomfortable. all right. Well, thank you, Sarah. This is great. We'll have to have you in again sometime.
I would love that.
We can talk to you
so
for
much.
Hours.
Oh, love it. Thank you.
Sarah Kalin, guys. Yeah.
Get a whole lot more Preston and Steve at PrestonandSteve.com.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Like most of us, Keith Urban also has a bucket list. You may be surprised to learn what is and is not on his. Text Keith to 45911 to read and learn more about the central theme of Keith's bucket list. Get a link to the story sent right to your phone when you text Keith to 45911. Go inside country music at BackstageCountry.com.